With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. WAPA, also known as the Western Agricultural Processors Association, is hosting their 9th annual AgOne Trap Shoot. The event is taking place in January. This community favorite event includes lunch, raffles, and of course, clay shooting, all to support the Jordan College of Agriculture Sciences and Technology program at Fresno State. It's held at the Kingsburg Gun Club, and all skill levels are welcome. Awards will be given for the top two teams as well as the top individual. For more information, you can contact the AgOne Foundation or visit their website, agonefoundation.org. And now let's get into today's show headlines. New legislation to ensure precision technology for agriculture. In order to use drone technology to apply pesticides to agricultural crops in California, a person must go through a very lengthy process in order to get certified. A new law will help many farmers and ranchers have access to that precision agriculture farming technology, as well as the training needed to man it. Assembly Bill 1016 expedites training and licensing programs so that more farmers may use drones for their pesticide applications. The bill was crafted by Representative Reggie Jones Sawyer and sponsored by the California Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau President Jamie Johansson says, quote, "I'm proud that California Farm Bureau is leading the effort to ensure that farmers have access to precision technology. We thank Governor Gavin Newsom for supporting us by signing Assembly Bill 1016 with aerial spray technology within reach of all farmers for the first time. This will help them save on crop protection costs by allowing drones to target affected areas instead of the entire field. Drone use can also replace backpack spray and ground-based delivery systems with remote technologies, which protects our agricultural employers from close contact with pesticide applications." He adds, quote, "California farmers and ranchers lead the world in innovation, producing amazing yields of fresh produce, dairy, and meats, while decreasing water, fertilizer, and pesticide use. AB 1016 is a bill in that spirit. It allows farmers to better access innovative technology to gain even more efficiency and safety." And now here's Brian German with more Ag News.
2023 is turning out to be a memorable year for grape growers. Ranch manager for Marthadol Enterprises, Austin Hubble, said by and large the grape crop has been about 2 weeks late compared to what growers have experienced over the last 5 to 10 years.
When we look at growing degree days and things like that, we have kind of historically been a little bit ahead of average in recent history. So this season is perhaps a little bit behind the average, but we have, over the last decade, shifted some of our production practices to obviously reflect where the crop is. And so now we're getting a year that is something that is later than normal, and now we're having to readjust our practices to accommodate that. In terms of the weather we've experienced through the grape crops, we've seen a little bit of premature raisining and shriveling because of some of the heat we had earlier this summer.
Hubble said the unseasonable rain in August also didn't help things.
That has had an interesting impact on the industry. It certainly has not helped quality in terms of some of the issues seen by the mildew pressure this year. We have seen more incidences of bunch rot through this summer, and getting additional rainfall on top of that certainly did not make those issues better. And so we've been working very hard to try and minimize any of those issues. And I think that even some of the best grape growers in the valley, so to speak, have really been challenged by this season in how to make their programs work to keep their crops clean and to produce a good quality grape.
California Certified Organic Farmers is currently accepting applications for grants available through the Brickmont Hardship Assistance Fund. Organic farmers, ranchers, processors, and handlers who meet certain criteria may be eligible for the funding assistance. Grant amounts range between $1,000 and $20,000, depending on the type of grant awarded. Documentation of economic losses, financials, and proof of current organic certification are required to receive grant assistance. Completed applications are accepted online year-round, with grants awarded on a rolling basis, prioritized as first come, first served. A complete and detailed description of hardship endured within the last 12 months will be required as part of the application process. A final program report will need to be submitted 1 year after a grant is awarded through the program. More information about the Brickmont Hardship Assistance Fund is available at ccof.org. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
October 12th is National Farmers Day, a time dedicated to those who wake before the sun rises and often work until long after it sets. Thanks to farmers' tireless efforts, we have the food, feed, fiber, and fuel we need here in America and plenty more for export. Best of all, farmers produce all of this sustainably so that future generations can have the same bounty. Today and every day, please join Syngenta in honoring the men and women of American agriculture.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, the 2018 Farm Bill was not signed into law until December 20th of that year. That Farm Bill expired on September 30th, and work continued into December that year to pass the new legislation. It could take even longer this time around. Passing a new Farm Bill is usually a complicated process on its own, but the loss of Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House added a new twist to the legislation's fate. McCarthy was ousted last week. Greg Dowd is the COO of the National Milk Producers Federation.
And the first question U.S. agriculture should ask the new speaker is the Farm Bill, or will you please make the Farm Bill a big priority to get done ASAP, please? And we have to know what the answer to that is.
Ag committee lawmakers in the House and Senate have spent thousands of hours over the past 2 years collecting feedback from constituents on what they want to see in the multi-year bill that is forecast to cost over $1 trillion. Dowd says the final discussions on the Farm Bill are basically regional fights over what's left in the pie.
What the staff has done is put pen to paper, and what they're really doing is going through and amending the law. So it's Microsoft Word, deleting and inserting, deleting and inserting. You've got the lawyers that have made the changes. It's taken longer than usual this time around, because every time you make one of those changes, you have to submit the language then to the Congressional Budget Office. And then they give you back, well, that if you do that, it costs this much money to make this specific change in this specific sentence. And so you have to collect all that information from the CBO to give to your boss to calculate, okay, every time I turn a dial in terms of making one of these changes, how does the money come out in the end? And so all of this process has gone through to a point we are just about ready to see. Now, this is jargon, but it is called the chairman's mark, which means Debbie Stabenow, Senator Stabenow, Chairwoman Stabenow, and then G.T. Thompson in the House will come out to the committee and say, here it is. This is the document for everybody to view. And then they will schedule a committee markup.
Colin Peterson of the Midwest Council of Ag, former chair of the House Agriculture Committee, says the leading candidates for Speaker of the House, Steve Scalise and Jim Jordan, both have a history with agriculture and perhaps not a good history.
You got Jim Jordan, who has never voted for a farm bill or never supported anything that we've tried to do. If he gets to be Speaker, I think we're dead in the water. Now, there's some Republicans that say, well, he's changed and all of a sudden he's not the way he used to be. I don't really believe that.
Peterson says Scalise did not vote for the last farm bill.
So he's got a checkered record, but he comes from Louisiana. He used to be a Democrat. He's one of those, he would have been a blue dog, probably, if he'd have come along at the right time. And, you know, he's one of these guys that knows how to wheel and deal and make things work. So he's always supported sugar, you know, because of Louisiana and rice, cotton, so forth. But so it's going to depend on who emerges out of this deal. And, you know, I think Scalise will be a strong ally of Thompson's to push this in the House.
While the Speaker of the House situation is problematic, Peterson says Senate Ag Committee ranking member John Bozeman has threatened not to support a bill if it doesn't increase reference prices for southern crops like rice, cotton, and peanuts.
This is goes back to how these reference prices kind of got out of whack starting in 2002. And so those commodities, their reference prices are high enough already that the 115% of the market does not affect them. So they won't, under the way this thing is structured, they won't get any increase. Now, some people would argue, well, they were getting a better deal before and the corn and soybeans were catching up and so forth, you know, and that's going to be a whole other debate. But this is a big reason why we may not get a farm bill, because people have taken this position that they're going to raise reference prices. It costs a lot of money, and the money is not there.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, for the past few weeks, the National Milk Producers Federation has been involved in testimony concerning the USDA's Federal Milk Marketing Order Modernization, or FMMO, hearing. During a recent podcast, Peter Vitliano, NMPS Vice President for Economic Policy and Market Research, talked about the hearing and what they've been working to do.
It's almost 2 years now since National Milk began crafting a very carefully balanced proposal that is in the interest of dairy farmers and their marketing cooperatives. I think we're doing a great job of presenting our case at this hearing. That's the whole purpose of the hearing, to make in great detail, based on factual evidence, for our proposal, which our board of directors approved unanimously. We are encountering stiff opposition, primarily from the processor groups. We anticipated that, despite the fact that the Secretary of ILSEC requested the parties to all come together in agreement. We tried that. It was not really possible, and we're seeing that play out here at the hearing. We're finding basically the processor group is arguing one way or another that anything that would improve producer prices and, by extension, the effective operation of the federal order system, they tend to oppose. Anything that would lower producer prices, they're supportive of. And that's not really too overly simplistic a read on the proposal. We have a more balanced proposal where some prices would go up, some would go down, but all in the best interest on balance positive for U.S. dairy farmers. Because this, I remind you, the federal order pricing provisions are long overdue for an update. Their outdatedness is now starting to cause significant problems. And it is very important that we make these changes and basically enable the program to operate much more effectively than it is now.
Vitliano notes that various dairy producers have also taken part in this hearing process.
The people who've been participating generally know a lot about the system. We've had a number of dairy producers that have cycled through and given testimony. They've been lightly treated in terms of cross-examination. Those of us who are not dairy farmers have not been so gently treated, but that's our job. And I confess to a guilty pleasure in actually enjoying stiff cross-examination because our proposals are eminently defensible. But it has been a great education for all of us, including those of us who know a fair amount of the system, to be reacquainted with the fundamental purpose of the order program and what is needed to basically modernize it in the face of the very, very significant changes the industry has gone through structurally. Since, you know, basically the current provisions, which were set in place in the year 2000 and have not been changed very much since then.
For more information on NMPF's FMMO efforts, go to their website, nmpf.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A scholarship opportunity for veterinary students. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The National Dairy Herd Information Association announced it's accepting applications for $1,500 scholarships. They'll go to third or fourth year College of Veterinary Medicine students. Applicants must be enrolled at a college that's accredited by the American Veterinary Medical Association Council on Education. To apply for a scholarship, applicants must submit a letter of application and two reference letters. The letter of application requires young people to submit information like their area of specialty or interest, academic background, career plans, and other important information. Scholarship committee members will evaluate applicants based on overall interest as a veterinarian planning to work in dairy, also involvement in dairy medicine, extracurricular activities, and interest in dairy software and dairy records to improve dairy management and animal health. Applications are due on December 31st. Specific application requirements are on the National DHIA website, which you can find on our website, agnetwest.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullen. A lien gives the lien holder an enforceable right against certain property that can be used to pay a debt or obligation of the property's owner. Most states have laws that give particular persons a lien by statute in specific circumstances. These statutory liens generally have priority over prior perfected security interests. I'll be back in a moment to discuss a recent case involving a veterinarian's lien.
Agriculture needs the next generation. Kansas State University's College of Agriculture prepares students through applied learning, internships, and research. Learn more at ag.ksu.edu.
I'll get back to the report in a moment, but I want you to know that Schrader Real Estate and Auction Company has sold farm and ranch land and farm equipment in 40 states. Learn how the Schrader family can help your family. Visit SchraderAuction.com. That's S-C-H-R-A-D-E-R Auction.com. The rationale behind statutory liens is that certain parties who have contributed inputs or services to another should have a first claim for payment. But you have to be able to prove entitlement to the lien. In a recent case, a veterinarian treated a rancher's cattle. The rancher didn't pay the vet bill, and while the bill remained outstanding, the vet came into possession of cattle that the rancher was grazing for another party. The vet cared for the cattle for over 2 months and then filed a lien for his services. Ultimately, the cattle were sold at a sheriff's sale, and the rancher's lender claimed it had a prior lien on the proceeds. Normally, the veterinarian's lien would beat out the lender's lien, but the court concluded that the veterinarian couldn't establish who actually delivered the cattle to him or that the rancher requested his services. The court said the vet didn't meet his burden of proof to establish that the lien was valid. While liens have priority, their validity still must be established. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullen.
How might the U.S. farm economy look in the closing months of 2023? USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer recently provided insight during the AgriPulse Agricultural Outlook Forum. He starts with what farm producers might receive price-wise for their commodities.
As we go forward for this crop year that we're at, it's basically lower prices for every crop. All the major crops we follow, we're coming down off of those very high prices, livestock being the exception on cattle and for swine.
So where is price uncertainty for major commodities? Corn, soybeans, wheat.
We're kind of heading in a direction where the market's much more sanguine about supplies for corn, for beans, and yet we maintain a fair amount of uncertainty for wheat. And I think that's not surprising given what we're observing in the Black Sea.
The chief economist adds that regarding potential market volatility for corn and beans,
at a global level, we're facing increased competition, and that's also why I think you're seeing the volatility narrow. There appear to be substantive enough crops that folks aren't anxious about the pricing of those crops.
While for wheat, in the context of market volatility,
Australian production should fall because we're switching to an El Nino, perhaps not a surprise after 3 years of strong production. And then Russian wheat production falling, that's quite a big decline year over year. But another important aspect in global markets is that the Russians had an enormous crop last year. That's an important aspect in global markets for prices, for food security, and part of the reason why you see increased volatility in wheat that you don't see in corn and beans.
What about farm income forecasts for 2023? Meyer starts with a reminder of farm income last year.
With falling prices, falling input prices, or slowing growth in input prices, we certainly saw in 2022 record farm income, but it wasn't without a tremendous amount of anxiety. Input prices were uncertain, rising high. Ended up being a good year for many commodities, corn, beans, cattle, maybe less so for some other commodities. But what we saw is high prices for those commodities, good farm income, but with a lot of anxiety.
So for this year,
now we see both prices coming down and inputs coming down, or at least slowing in the growth of those input prices, but with some narrowing of margins, coming up from very high farm income down to more normal levels of farm income.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
USDA will give us a much better idea of 2023 production tomorrow, and farmers and ranchers collecting Social Security will find out how much of a cost of living adjustment coming their way in 2024. I'm Mark Oppold with today's Bottom Line Report, brought to you by Kloss Equipment. Bottom Line economists see a 3 to 3.5% increase in tomorrow's cost of living adjustment by the Social Security Administration. That's a steep decline from the 8.7 jump last year. That was the highest in 40 years, of course, with inflation. The average increase the past 20 years has been near 2.5%. The grain trade getting the October update tomorrow morning. December corn failure to advance on the run-up in crude oil indicates the trade is keenly focused on good harvest progress. Now, that progress will be delayed in many areas with widespread rain coming late week, and a tropical storm will dump heavy rain in the southeast and delta. But it's October 11th, not November 11th. Plenty of calendar left to complete the harvest. Now's your chance to refuel your farm equipment for free, thanks to Kloss. Register for your chance to win $10,000 worth of free farm diesel. Go to fuel.kloss.com. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
The chants were fast.
12,
the cattle were good.
12,
and buyers were interested. At Torrington Livestock Market, September 11th. And auctioneers gave their all.
16, now 17, $17. 17.
Up for grabs? Buckles, bragging rights, and most of all, a step closer to the annual World Livestock Auctioneer Championship next June. This competition was the first of three qualifier events, with more than 4,000 cattle of all types being sold. The contest was competitive, yet contestants like Jason Santamasso of Sterling, Colorado say the camaraderie is important.
We're all rooting for each other. We're all working for the same goal, to better the industry and better the cattle market. And it's the friendships. And I've made a lot of my best friends are from this contest.
Santamasso made the top 10, so he qualifies for the WLAC contest. Wade Leisch of Boyne City, Michigan, came out on top at the event and was named a qualifying champion. Jace Thompson of Billings, Montana, was named reserve champion and high score rookie. And Brennan Jack of Verdon, Manitoba, was runner-up. When asked how he planned for the day, Santamasso says he simply set a goal to advance to the next round.
Just decided I was going to get up there and have fun. Just pretend like I was at my own barn and selling, and that's what I did. And I made it. So I made the top 10. That's what I was trying for.
Thompson says the event was an incredible learning experience, thanks to the high-quality contestants.
They range from up by New York all the way to California, Montana, Texas, so they're all over the country, and they get the chance to be around a lot of different cattle, a lot of different operators in a lot of different facilities, and you can learn a lot.
In all, 10 happy auctioneers from this event move on to the championship contest next year. For Livestock Marketing Association, I'm Bob Cervera.
2024 marks the 100th anniversary of USDA's Agricultural Outlook Forum.
Perhaps the most significant detail about the 2024 USDA Agricultural Outlook Forum is...
This is the 100th Agricultural Outlook Forum, so started back in 1924.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekodowski providing some of the initial details regarding next year's Centennial Ag Outlook Forum, including...
Note on the date, because the forum is actually going to take place 1 week earlier than it has over the past several years. So it's going to be February 15th and 16th.
Also announced, the theme of the upcoming forum.
The theme is cultivating the future. So it's sort of a recognition that we've hit that 100-year milestone.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
And now a really bad song about fall.
Oh, I feel like I'm falling for fall.
Falling for fall, yes. Well, now, many of us are inspired to do our work on the lawn in the springtime. But one expert says if you have cool season grasses like bluegrass or tall fescue when fall comes,
that grass really breaks dormancy and takes off and starts growing. So a lot of times, it's a great time to get in there and do some work.
Dennis Patton is a Kansas State University Extension lawn and garden expert, and he says fall is the preferred time to do three things that most of us try to do in the spring.
Fertilization be one. Here again, the lawns are hungry after the long, hot, dry summer. Two would be if we've got some thin or dead spots, get in there and overseed or reseed the lawn. And the third practice that's really great done in the fall is something called core aeration, or aerating your lawn, which removes plugs of soil about the size of a finger out of the lawn that then helps repair the soil, loosens, breaks up the soil, also helps water nutrients move down into the soil for healthy roots.
Now today we're going to focus on seeding or overseeding.
Seeding is an art and a science.
But mostly science, though. Patton says if you seed in the fall, you have a much better chance of getting a really good stand of grass, but not if you make a lot of mistakes.
I think the most common mistake people make is they don't properly prepare the soil.
Patton says do not just go out and throw out some seeds on the ground, like I do, and expect results. You have to first get the ground ready.
What really needs to occur for a good seeding project is to make sure we get good seed-soil contact. And that is usually done with a process called verticut, or verticutting your lawn. And what this verticut does, it's a machine you can rent or hire someone to do, and it slices small grooves down into the soil that breaks through that soil crust in that thatch layer, and then it allows for that seed to fall down into those grooves. Then when we start watering, we get good seed-soil contact, which in turn then lead to better germination.
Yes, and on that watering, you don't just do it a couple of times a week.
Because our goal is to keep that upper inch or so of the soil moist at all times during the germination process, which is probably going to take a minimum of a week to 10 days to 2 weeks, depending on the type of seed and your soil condition.
And finally, Dennis Patton recommends what's called starter fertilizer, which has a lot more phosphorus in it.
Because there is scientific research to back up that a little free phosphorus right around that germinating seed will help increase root development and growth.
So do a good seeding job now so your yard won't look seedy like mine does come spring, and your newly planted grass will be better able to handle the stress that will come with the hot summer weather. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the show. For today's interview segment, we have part two of the Vineyard Team's podcast, where host Craig McMillan talks with Katie Gold at Cornell Agritech all about NASA satellites detecting grapevine diseases from space.
So the idea here is that there are changes in the leaf that can be picked up in these other wavelengths that we wouldn't see until it's too late.
Exactly.
Okay, so it's a warning sign.
Yeah.
That gives us a chance to change management.
Ideally so, right? So it depends on what the scale at which you're operating. So now here comes another level, right? So if you're considering just that one individual plant, it's different from when you're considering the whole scale of a vineyard, right? You want your sensing to be right sized to the intervention that you're going to take. So my group works with two types of diseases primarily. We work with grapevine viral diseases as well as grapevine foliar diseases. For example, grapevine downy mildew, which is an oomycete caused by an oomycete pathogen, and grapevine powdery mildew, which is caused by a fungal pathogen. Now, the sort of intervention that you would take for those two diseases is very different, right? With a viral disease, the only treatment that you have is removal. There's no cure for being infected with the virus. Now, with a fungal pathogen or an oomycete pathogen like grapevine downy mildew, if you detect that early, there are fungicides you can use with kickback action Or otherwise, you might change the sort of what sort of choice you might make a fund decide, right? If you know there's an actual risk in this location, you might put your most heavy hitting fungicides there. Then in areas where there is no disease detected or risk is incredibly low, you might feel more comfortable relying on a biological, thereby reducing the impact. So given the sort of intervention you would take, we want to right size our sensing approach for it. So with grapevine viral diseases, when the intervention is so has such a vast financial impact, right, removal, we want to be incredibly sure of our data. So we focus on high spectral resolution data products for that. Ones where we have lots of wavelengths being measured with the most precise accuracy so that we can have high confidence in that result, right? We want to give that to someone and say, hey, we are very confident this is undergoing asymptomatic infection. Now, on the other hand, with these foliar diseases, they change at such a rapid timescale that you're more benefited by having an early warning that may be less accurate, right? So you're saying, hey, this area of your vineyard is undergoing rapid change. It might be due to the disease. It might be because your kid drove a golf cart through the vineyard. However, we're warning you regardless to send someone out there and take a look and make a decision as to what you might do. Ideally, we would have a high spectral resolution regardless, right? Because more spectrum or better, but the realities of the physics and the actual logistics of doing these sensing is that we don't get to do that. We have to do a trade-off with spectral, spatial, and temporal resolution. So if we want rapid return, high degrees of monitoring, and we want that at high spatial resolution suitable for a vineyard, we lose our spectral resolution. So we lose our confidence in that result, but our hope is that by saying, hey, this is a high area of change and getting you that information very quickly, you can still make an intervention that will be yield successful response, right? You'll go out there and you're like, oh, yep, that's downy mildew. Otherwise, like, I'm going to take my kid's keys. Like, he's out here in my vineyard again.
Right.
So it's kind of we're balancing, right? So we have the logistics of the real world to contend with in terms of using sensing to make, to inform management intervention.
This technology can be used or applied at a variety of distances, if I understand. Everything from proximal, like driving through a vineyard, to satellite.
Oh, yeah. And we work with everything.
Yeah. And everything in between. I mean, you can do flyovers. A lot of companies that do NDVIs with flyover.
You can use robots like we do.
We can use robots. There's all kinds of things we can do. Oh, what is NDVI for the audience? Even though that's not what we're talking about. You and I keep using it.
So NDVI stands for Normalized Difference Vegetative Index. It's a normalized difference between near-infrared light reflecting and red light. And it is probably the most accurate measurement we have of how green something is. And it's quite a powerful tool. You know, we've been using NDVI for well over 50 years to measure how green the Earth is from space. That's powerful. But the power of NDVI is also its downside in that because it is so effective at telling you how green something is, it cannot tell you why something is green. Or it cannot tell you why something is not green. It's going to pick up on a whole range of subtle things that impact plant health.
And whereas the kind of work that you're doing differs from that in that it's looking at different frequencies and a higher resolution of frequencies.
Exactly. So for the most part, we do use NDVI, but we use it more as a stepping stone, a filtering step rather than the kind of end-all be-all. Additionally, too, we use an index that's a cousin to NDVI called EDI, that is adjusted for blue light reflectance, which is very helpful in the vineyard because it helps you deal with the shadow effects given the trellising system of a vineyard. But yes, exactly. We, for the most part, are looking at more narrow intervals of light than NDVI in ranges beyond what NDVI is measuring.
What's the resolution from space?
That's a great question.
What's the pixel size?
One of the commercial satellite products we work with has half a meter resolution from space.
Wow.
Yeah, 50 centimeters, which is amazing. Yeah, that was exactly my reaction when I heard about it. I was like, gotta get my hands on this. But as I mentioned before, right, you know, with that resolution, we trade off the spectral resolution. So actually that imagery only has four bands. It effectively is quite similar to an NDVI sensor, though we do have a little more flexibility. We can calculate different indices with it. So we use that data product, 50 centimeters. We use 3 meter data products from commercial sources. And then we're also looking towards the future. A lot of my lab is funded by NASA in support of a future satellite that's going to be launched at the end of the decade called Surface Biology and Geology. And this is going to put a full range hyperspectral imager into space that will yield global coverage for the first time. So this satellite will have 30 meter resolution. And it will have that amazing spectral resolution, about 10-day return, and that 30-meter spatial size. So again, kind of mixing and matching. You don't get to optimize all three resolutions at once, unfortunately. Maybe sometime in my career, I'll get to the point where I get to optimize exactly what I want, but I'm not there yet.
And I hadn't thought about that. So there's also there's a time lag between when the data comes in and when it can be used.
Yes.
What are those lags like?
It depends. So with some of the NASA data that we work with, it can be quite lagged because it's not designed for rapid response. It's designed for research grade, right? So it's assuming that you have time and it's going through a processing stage. It's going through corrections, et cetera. And this process is not designed to be rapid because it's not for rapid response. Otherwise, sometimes when we're working with commercial imagery, that can be available. If we task it, it can be available to us within 24 hours. So that's if I say, hey, make me an acquisition, and they do, and then within 24 hours, I get my imagery in hand. Otherwise, too, there's delays up to 7 days, but for the most part, you can access commercial satellite imagery of a scene of your choosing, generally within 24 hours, of about 3 meter resolution to half a meter resolution. That is if you're willing to pay, not available from the space agencies.
Again, this was just a portion of their conversation. For more information, visit vineyardteam.org. Stay tuned, we'll have more Ag News after the break.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Deputy Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation, Gloria Montano-Green, discusses a new pilot program addressing ag workforce challenges and upcoming deadlines for project funding applications.
It is with FSA, but it's in collaboration with the Agricultural Marketing Service as well. So it is a couple departments or a couple areas within USDA that are working for it. The Farm Labor Stabilization Program will allow us to provide opportunities for funding for ag employers to support their workers, domestic and immigrant as well. It will help accelerate that ag employer's efforts to have competitive employers of choice by improving the quality of the jobs they offer. And then for us, we'll be able to have an idea of the communities that are out there moving to be able to support. The work will be able to fund various items. It's kind of an open program. We know that there's a lot of things that producers are already doing. They're wanting to be able to have eligibility for funds to be able to make sure that they're able to implement some of these labor practices. And so the maximum award is $2 million. The minimum award is $25,000 per grant, and you can have sub-awardees. And the application is currently open through November 28th of 23.
If you'd like to find out more information, you can visit www.fpacbc.usda.gov.
The Global Produce and Floral Show is coming up next week in Anaheim. The International Fresh Produce Association will be offering educational sessions covering consumer, tech, and talent trends at the Global Produce and Floral Show, October 19th through the 21st at the Anaheim Convention Center. The first day of the conference will begin with a general state of the industry presentation, followed by discussions on fresh produce packaging, getting the job done with a changing workforce, generation-based marketing, and controlled environment agriculture. October 20th will cover topics including FSMA traceability, tracking and measuring sustainability, and regenerative agriculture. The final day of the conference will feature presentations on pathogen testing, equipment sanitation, and improving access to produce through innovation. More information about the conference is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Just how close will the new USDA crop report be to actual output? Lance Honig, chief of the crops branch of the USDA's National Agriculture Statistics Service, says that the upcoming USDA crop production report should be very close to what actual production turns out to be.
What's really interesting about the October report is this is really the first report where now we're into harvest. And so when we start collecting data, whether it be from a farmer or from the objective yield work where we actually go into the fields ourselves, now we're talking about mature crops. And we're talking about, in some cases, actual harvest results showing up in the data that's being reported. So when we make these forecasts that you see in the October report, they're going to be a lot closer to final typically, because now everybody sees firsthand what the yields really are this season.
USDA will release its October crop production report and its World Ag Supply and Demand estimates coming up tomorrow, October 12th. Washington Clean Fuel Standard impressive first quarter. The Washington Clean Fuel Standard is off to an impressive start with the release of its first quarter result for the number of credits generated by alternative low-carbon fuels. These figures demonstrate the program's commitment to reducing carbon emissions, supporting local economies, and fostering a unified market for biomass-based diesel on the West Coast. Preliminary data shows that biodiesel and renewable diesel contributed around 22% of the credits, indicating an approximate 1.2% blend rate. In comparison, when California first implemented its low-carbon fuel standard, the state saw a blend rate of 0.4% for biodiesel and renewable diesel in the first year. Replicating California's fuel standard, Washington adopted their own clean fuel standard in 2021. In an effort to reduce carbon intensity in the transportation sector, the state's largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. The program provides credits for low-carbon fuel alternatives that improve air quality and economic growth. B contributed to that report.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.